On this Sunday morning, we continue our series of faculty readings from this summer's Antioch Writers Workshop with Matthew Goodman from his latest book, 80 Days. He begins by giving some background about this book's subject, Nellie Bly.
I live in Brooklyn, not far from the site of the old Nellie Bly amusement park. So I lived for many years metaphorically in the shadow of Nellie Bly, and I'm still living today, in a sense, in her shadow. Nellie Bly was this amazing, audacious, courageous, difficult journalist, female journalist in the 1880s, who was an undercover investigative reporter for Joseph Pulitzer's newspaper, The World. And in 1889, she decided that she was going to go around the world faster than anyone had ever done it before to try to beat in real life the mark of 80 days set by Phileas Fogg in Jules Verne's novel. So she went to her editors and she proposed it, and they said, no, absolutely not. This was a time, of course, when male newspaper editors didn't even like their female reporters to go across the city unchaperoned, and Nellie Bly was saying, I'm going to go around the world by myself. And they said to her, quote, only a man can do this, and she responded by saying, very well, you send your man, and I will start for some other paper, and I will beat him. And that's the way that Nellie Bly was. And, of course, part of the reason they said no was that, you know, the idea was that a woman going around the world would have to take 11 steamer trunks to carry all the ball gowns and the various accoutrements that she would need for such a trip. And so Nellie Bly said, I will carry everything I need in one handbag, which she did for this 2.5-month trip. And that actual bag is now on display in Washington, D.C. at the museum, and it is tiny. It's very moving, actually, to see. So I'm going to read a section from this, 80 Days. And this is Nellie Bly on her first ocean voyage, leaving New York for England on the Augusta Victoria steamship. Bly's first attack of seasickness had occurred within minutes of the ship setting out, and her physical discomfort had been made far worse by the fear that she might be sick for the 70 days of her journey to be spent on the water. It was a reasonable enough concern. She had, after all, never been on a long sea voyage, and so had not developed her sea legs, the tolerance to a boat's rocking motion that seemed to build up over time, like a violinist's callus, inuring one to future discomfort. Moreover, it was widely known that women suffered more than men from seasickness, a misery that, like the pains of labor, could never be adequately communicated to those who had not experienced it. The sufferer was liable to feel at once freezing and feverish, unable to sit up without a sickening nausea. Even the softest and most innocuous sounds, a creak of a floorboard, the lapping of the waves, reverberated inside the head as loudly and unnervingly as the yowl of an alley cat. The wretchedness of the condition was perhaps best conveyed by the old saying that those suffering from seasickness believe they will die on the first day, are sure they will on the second, and hope they will on the third. After her first voyage to Europe, Harriet Beecher Stowe had written, I wonder that people who wanted to break the souls of heroes and martyrs never thought of sending them to sea and keeping them a little seasick. Worse still, one could not be sure how long an attack would last, nor that any of the proffered remedies would actually lessen its agonies, for even after millennia of human travel on the water, little was known about the malady's prevention or cure. Those afflicted were variously instructed to lie down and to stand up, to rest and to exercise, to seek out darkness and light. They were advised to drink champagne, port, brandy, rum, or salt water. The latter treatment, it was admitted, quote, makes the drinker very miserable for a few minutes. To eat chicken, oysters, celery, marmalade, hot West Indian pickles, or to eat nothing at all. In his practical treatise on seasickness, 1880, Dr. George M. Beard suggested chloral hydrate, more popularly known as knockout drops, though he cautioned that it was not recommended for daily use. Lunch was served on the Augusta Victoria at 1 o'clock. On the first day, still weak from her earlier attack of seasickness, Bly made her way to the first-class passengers' dining hall in the ship's deckhouse. It was a large room decorated in a Rococo style that the industry journal The Marine Engineer graciously termed mixed Renaissance. Overhead arched a canopy of stained glass. There were bronze statues, gilded mirrors, intricately painted panels done by the best artists of the German school. Stewards in full dress and white gloves moved noiselessly about, seeming to anticipate passengers' needs before they were spoken. A group of musicians, the stewards of the second class hall, a dining hall, hired in part for their musical skills, played an overture for the passengers as they arrived. As an honored guest, Bly was seated at the captain's table in the armchair directly to his left. Soon the captain himself, handsome and bearded, took his place at the head of the table. The waiters ladled out the soup. Bly discovered that she had an overwhelming desire not to see, smell, or taste food, at least until they had reached land. The passengers began to introduce themselves. To Bly's embarrassment, the others at the table turned out to be old hands at ocean crossings, and she thought she saw indulgent smiles on all their faces when feeling another attack coming on. She put a handkerchief over her mouth and did her best to excuse herself politely from the table. "Miss Bly," said Captain Albers, "you must come back every time." One of the stewards helped her to a secluded spot on the deck where again she was sick. Back inside the dining room, she was greeted with a hearty round of congratulations for her fortitude. "The only way to conquer seasickness is by forcing oneself to eat," the captain noted approvingly. But the bravos of her table mates only made her more conscious of her precarious condition. And when the fish course was placed before her, she felt her stomach start to turn, and choking behind her handkerchief, she was forced to excuse herself to the deck for a second time. Bly, though, had made up her mind that she could not afford to be seasick, that she would heed as long as she could the captain's advice to keep coming back to the table. And so, like a boxer who returns to the center of the ring after having been knocked down, she returned again on unsteady legs to the warmth and murmur of the dining room. She was aware now that every unexpected sensation, the flare of a light, a food's aroma, even the expression on someone's face, could by itself bring on a new wave of nausea. The band still played its distressing tunes. She did her best to focus on the story the captain was telling. Once she caught the eye of a waiter who seemed to be watching her with an amused gleam in his eye. Again, Bly felt sick, and for the third time, blindly, despairingly, she rushed out of the dining room. Staggering once more back inside, she now felt that she had already passed over to the third stage of seasickness, in which one hopes for death. Her head was on fire, but her hands and feet seemed to be encased in ice. She tried to keep as still as possible. She felt she could scarcely remember a time when moving had not been a misery. The courses arrived in seemingly endless succession. She spoke little and ate less, and it was all she could do when at last the final course had been served to mumble that the meal had been very good and then excuse herself and head wobblingly back to her cabin, where she crawled into bed and almost immediately fell asleep. She slept all through the night. Later, she would recall some dim, awful dream and waking up once to take a few sips of tea, but beyond this, all was oblivion, until she heard a voice calling her name. Opening her eyes, she found a stewardess and one of the female passengers in her cabin, and Captain Albers standing at the door. "We were afraid that you were dead," he said jovially. "I always sleep late in the morning," she said, in as apologetic a tone as she could muster. "In the morning," exclaimed the captain with a laugh, "it is 4:30 in the afternoon." "But never mind," he added, "as long as you slept well, it will do you good. Now get up and see if you can't eat a big dinner." Feeling half-drugged with sleep, Bly pulled herself out of bed and drank a cup of tea. When she went back up on deck, she found, to her great relief, that she felt perfectly well, and at dinner that evening, she did not miss a course. Thank you very much.
Matthew Goodman from his latest book, 80 Days. More from the Antioch Writers Workshop next Sunday morning on WISO Weekend.